Da-da-da. Okay, hello everyone. This is your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim Abdullah Samir here, joined by Apostate Prophet. Hello.
Your friendly neighborhood's prophet. Hello.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. So we talked about doing this a long time ago, and somehow it just never happened. And then we actually got into a bit of a fight online. At one point, but we've made up now, and I want to start off by actually I want to share my screen. I want to share something that's I think very cool. I've got a couple of these before, so this is not the first time, but like thank you messages from people, and a lot of the time it actually mentions Apostate Prophet. So this fellow said, "Hello, Abdullah, I want to thank you for your articles, especially your videos in Indonesian here, and I've followed your videos in YouTube along with those of Apostate Prophet, Thurman Trees, and others." So there's been quite a few times where both of us have had, common thank you messages for what we've been doing, and that just shows you that different approaches work for different people. How did you start? How did this whole thing start for you? Like, how did you end up being an activist? Normally, people that become activists is because they're very motivated. They have something that they've actually, a price they paid, something that happened to them. How did you end up becoming the prophet?
Well, my issue is different. I'm just like Muhammad. I'm a destroyer. I want to destroy things that exist, like Islam. No, it's st seriously.
Like what?
It's getting very dark there. No, I left. I was a religious Muslim quite a while ago. And I stopped believing in Islam around 2014. Then I stopped believing in God after questioning God for a while, about a year later or so, or maybe less than a year, I don't know. And then I think it was in 2016 that I first created an Instagram account, because I was looking online, in my whole time where I was questioning after I stopped believing in Islam and in God. I was looking for entertainment and questions and memes and stuff like that online on the atheist community. And at that time, it was like there was virtually no anti-Islam. There was virtually no ex-Muslim stuff online. It was and which is crazy to think of, because that was only 4 years ago. I couldn't find any ex-Muslim anti-Islam stuff. It was
Well,
all just Christianity.
I feel, yeah, the majority of pages back then were Christian pages. Answering Islam was the biggest one, actually. And Sam Moon, David Wood, these guys actually put together a lot of information. And believe it or not, when I became Sunni Muslim, like I converted from Ismailism back in, I don't remember now, like 17 years ago, something like that, 20, maybe 20 years ago almost. I actually came across Answering Islam even back then. And I read the article about the sun setting in the murky ocean, believe it or not. So even back then, when I was becoming like a religious Muslim, I was looking for a little bit of, I was being a little bit skeptical. And I have a younger brother who also became Sunni Muslim, and he became very religious as well. And I actually told him I couldn't find any problems in the Quran except for this thing. That's what I said. Based on the little bit of research I did, that was the one thing I did. And then I said, well, maybe it was just an, like a metaphor of like the sun looks like it's going in a sea. And I'm like, ah, that's, don't worry about that. That's not a big deal. And then we both became like super religious. But
That's
that's
funny.
great. That was the entirety of the stuff that was available, was all Christian anti-Islamic content, right?
And there was like when there was atheist stuff around, especially on Instagram and other platforms, it was just anti-Christian atheist stuff. And whenever Islam was mentioned, people would go like, why do you have to single out Islam? And I looked at that stuff and I was like, what is happening? These people have no idea what they're talking about. So I don't know. I met my wife then, And she kind of encouraged me. You know, I was talking to her. I was saying, hey, I have so much stuff to say. You know, I know these Islamic missionaries. I was kind of one myself back then. I was an apologist. I know all the stuff that these people are talking about. And I know that this atheist community has no idea about Islam. They have no idea. They have no idea what Islam is. I wish I could go out there and tell them these things. And then my wife was like, why don't you just do it? Why don't you just create some accounts and start sharing stuff about Islam and let it all out? And I thought, maybe I should do that. So I created some Instagram accounts, and those are very extremely provocative. I created a thing first called The Prophet, an account called The Prophet. And I was kind of banned after just a few weeks because of my explicit criticism of Islam. Then I created like The Prophet 2, which was also banned. Then Prophet 3, which was also banned. Then Prophet 4, which was also banned. And then I got sick of that, and I was constantly being targeted by Muslims. So I changed it. I thought, let me think of something nice. I also don't want to be targeted over and over again because of the whole The Prophet label. So I thought, okay, what about Apostate Prophet? So I switched to Apostate Prophet, and suddenly it started growing very well. I reached like 10,000 followers on Instagram or so. And then I thought, this is not enough. You know, I have to do more. I have to find a better platform where I can express everything that I actually want to tell people. And what better platform would there be than YouTube? But I was still in Turkey at that time. So in Turkey, I didn't want to live in Turkey, where it's a crime to criticize the religion of the public. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I moved to America, and then I thought, okay, that's it. I will now create a YouTube account. Funnily enough, I created my YouTube account. I announced it on Instagram. People came over to YouTube, and then my Instagram account was banned entirely, permanently. And then I completely quit Instagram. But then the whole YouTube thing started going very well. And I don't know. It's pretty big now.
It's interesting that YouTube actually has given us this space.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, like, it's actually a good thing. We complain a lot about the Western sort of liberal-leaning tech companies, which they are very liberal-leaning. But for some reason, we've been okay on YouTube. And I mean, that's a good thing. I don't know why that is. I don't know how we've managed, not just you, not just me, not just the Masked Arab. Although the Masked Arab almost lost his channel at one point, and was taken down. All of his videos were unlisted or something. And then there was a huge outcry from all of us, and they brought it back. But I was at that point when he realized that, and who knows? I mean, it might not continue. There's no guarantees. None of us has any sort of stamp of approval from YouTube saying that they're going to allow us to continue this activism work online. It's interesting how different our approaches are. Like, I used to actually come from the perspective that mocking was a bad thing. And I was like, I'm not going to mock. I'm just going to be very polite to people. I'm going to be very nice. And then I met Ali Zizbi, I met Armin, and we had a discussion about it. And actually, I've come to realize that, you know, different approaches can actually trigger the thinking process in different people. So sometimes, and actually Hirsch Sultan was another one who disagreed. And he's like, no, we need to like be more combative. And I've come to agree that I think in some cases it actually makes sense, because When you upset someone, it causes them to start thinking, and it also makes them real. And the other thing that's changed is, if anyone tells me you shouldn't mock Islam, then I will actually ask them, well, what about the Quran? Do you think that if you want to silence it? And this happened recently. This is a really weird thing happened to me. This guy, girl, probably guy on Twitter by the name of Rubik's Cube came all of a sudden out of nowhere, no followers, no, like just a new account. And says, Abdullah Samir doesn't represent the ex-Muslim community. He's something like, you know, he doesn't know anything and this. And I'm like, wait, who is this guy? I'm an atheist. His profile says I'm an atheist. I was like, what do you mean? And I had a conversation with him. I tried to have a conversation to say, like, what's your perspective? What's the problem with what I'm doing? And at the end of it, it was just like, you shouldn't insult the prophets. I was like, yes. And you're saying you shouldn't insult. What do you mean insult? You shouldn't insult the prophets means you shouldn't like say the false prophets. He's like, no, I'm not saying you can't say the false. I'm like, okay, but the Quran does the same thing. The Quran does even worse. Like, we don't even, when we're talking about Muslims, we actually avoid making over the generalizing statements and bigoted statements. We don't do that. But the Quran does that. The Quran actually says those who disbelieve are the worst, deaf, dumb, and blind. Like, it uses very harsh language towards groups of people.
You know what I think? I think when we talk about these, when we talk about our approaches and about how some approaches offend Muslims and offend Islam, and how, you know, a peaceful approach versus a very, very provocative approach. For example, if we compare you, I often see people compare you and me, whereas you have a very, very peaceful and very balanced approach, and I have a very very provocative approach and a lot of mockery, and which I enjoy, don't regret. I'm sorry, but the thing is. You know, the issue is, I think when we discuss this, when we discuss what approach is best, I think it's kind of a thing. We're kind of indulging the Muslim, the offended Muslims, and kind of just doing what an offended Muslim wants us to do. Just listening to their complaint. And the thing is, our approach doesn't really matter. Whether my approach, my approach or your approach doesn't really matter. The same people who complain about how antagonistic and how provocative I am. Know that you are more peaceful about this stuff, but still insult you, still complain about you, still call you all kinds of names, still harass you. It will always continue. You know, they will always have something to complain about, no matter how peaceful you are, no matter how reasonable you are to them. They will always have something to complain about, which is why I don't listen to that stuff. You know, I know that is really not about my approach. I know that it's really not about what words I use or my humor or my patience with them. It's not about that. It's about the mere fact that we criticize Islam. If I completely changed my approach and if I said, "Hey, I'm sorry for everything I've said in the past, and I don't want to make fun of Muhammad anymore. I don't want to mock and insult Allah anymore. I don't want to make fun of Islamic beliefs anymore. I will from now on have a completely reasonable approach to this, and I understand your concerns." They will still have the same complaints about me. They will still call me names. They will still complain about me. It doesn't stop. And I find that... Go ahead.
I was going to say something else happened to me. And despite the approach I have, someone tried to get me fired from my work. I mean, I was... I don't know exactly what it was. And I think it happened multiple times now. But eventually my boss actually had a conversation with my boss. And he actually told me that people actually called the office and said, this guy is a bigot. He hates Muslims and, you should not hire him. I mean, not hire him. I already worked there. You should fire him. You should terminate his employment. Never mind that he has a family to take care of or anything else. And, you know, I remember David Wood saying the same thing, that it actually resonated with me, that when he was in university, people tried to get him kicked out.
Yeah.
And then, like, what do you expect people to do if you treat them like, and this is despite the fact that I try to be a fair critic of Islam. I think we all try to be fair critics of Islam. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any point in doing this, right? But
yeah.
I try extra hard. And like you said, it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, people will still fight to shut you down no matter how you say it, no matter what you do, no matter how nice you are. It's never going to be nice enough, because if you just the fact that we exist and do this is a problem for people, right? And you know, people will say, like, someone will say, for example, what do you say to someone that says, well, no one's going to kill you. You're in America. Like, you're an apostate, but we don't kill apostates in America. So why are you even doing this? Like, no one's going to kill you.
Well, my response to that is usually I'm pretty sure that I won't die. I won't be killed. I won't be attacked by some crazy cuckoo radicalists or whatever you want to call it. That's because maybe I just have a lot of faith in humanity. Maybe I just think that even though most Muslims have a very hold on to very unthinkable ideas, most of them are still not ready to actually take the matter in their own hands and come and actually kill you. I'm not afraid of that personally. And in America, we have the means to protect ourselves. I have the FBI and the local police. But the thing is, when they say, well, you are an apostate, you live your life anyways, you're in America anyway, so what is it to you? Then it's like, That's a very dumb thing to say. It's not really about me. If it was only about me, I wouldn't be doing this. It's about humanity. It's about society. It's about ex-Muslims, atheists. It's about you, Muslims. It's about the minorities in Muslim countries. I mean, we have still in numerous Muslim countries, it is still forbidden to leave Islam. It is forbidden to criticize Islam. Imagine in 20 countries, imagine in 15 countries, it was forbidden to convert to Islam. I'm not presenting something absurd. It's the same thing. I mean, think about it. It is the same thing. Imagine it was forbidden to convert to Islam. Imagine the outcry. Imagine the Muslim outcry. They would be. I mean, they're already doing all kinds of chaos because of Israel. Imagine what they would do in such a case if 15 countries made it illegal, even if they didn't punish it. You know, I'm not talking about executing people. Even if they didn't set it in motion, if they didn't punish people, if they didn't execute or arrest people. Imagine it was just formally punished, formally illegal, officially illegal to convert to Islam. What would people think?
Yeah.
Would you still say, oh, it doesn't affect me, so I won't talk about that. It's nothing to me. No, you would go crazy about that. You would be mad about it. You would be angry. You would rise up and call the entire world and the United Nations and the Muslim world to unite and to end this cruelty. And that's what I'm doing.
And frankly speaking, at the end of the day, like, everyone has a right to talk about what's important to them.
Exactly.
So like, if like world hunger is important to you specifically, that doesn't mean you go down to everyone or veganism and say, oh, why don't you talk about this important issue that I care about? Because to me, this is the most important issue and I don't care about your issue. Well, everyone can talk about what they want to talk about, as long as we're not saying that those issues are not important. And we're not saying that. We're saying, yes, there's other important issues in the world. In order to make the world a better place, everyone should do something about things that matter to them, right? Because not everyone is also qualified to talk about everything, right? Yeah. So for example, I'm not, like, I don't know much about Christianity. And sometimes when I get into that conversation with people, I misspeak or I say something that, you know, out of ignorance, because, you know, by just assuming it's similar or based on my very little understanding that I have. So I can't be expected to, I mean, if I am expected to talk about it, I'm just not going to do a good job. And like you said, when you first came and you were leading these atheist, you know, like Reddit, subreddits and stuff like that, a lot of it is very Christian centric and it doesn't appeal to Muslims.
Yeah.
Because they're coming from a totally different worldview. Like Christianity, yes, it's similar in some ways to Islam. They're both theistic religions. But there's big differences. And so when you, sometimes the things you criticize in Christianity are not even issues in Islam because of the way the, you know, they've handled it, right? So someone coming from an ex-Christian perspective may not appeal to a Muslim because they're like, I don't even care about, oh, suffering in the world. Well, that's not an issue for me because Islam says blah, blah, blah. Like they have their own kind of, there's specific issues in Islam that people like us are able to talk about because we lived through it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, Christianity is also a beautiful religion. It's and I love Christianity. I'm just kidding. I'm just trying to make you mad because that's what we.
That was what we were actually had a little mini fight about, right? And it was all about Christianity and how beautiful Christianity is. And I mean, I'd say relatively speaking, Christianity is better than Islam because it's been around longer and it's had a lot long because of the fact that my perspective is because Christianity is, because we have secularism, let's just say that, because we have secularism, we don't have religious theocracy, so we're able to live our lives and it doesn't get in the way. I think my perspective is with Islam, it'd be the same thing eventually, that if Muslims are free to leave Islam, and there's no need for an ex-Muslim label then, because, well, whatever. Like, a good example of this actually is in China. There was, I wish he would have agreed. He didn't want to talk to me for some reason. I guess he didn't want to go on camera. But there was this one Muslim guy in China that told me that, I mean, that posted online. And he said that, you know, in China, we don't even have this thing called ex-Muslim because we have people that they don't really believe with the Muslim. They drink alcohol and they pray, they don't pray, whatever. Nobody cares. it's not like nobody has an expectation of you that you have to be this way if you're Muslim. It's just, you know what I'm saying? If so, they don't need an ex-Muslim label over there. And that is good. I'm not talking about what the Chinese are doing to the Muslims, but that's a totally different issue. That's bad. But this was aside from that world thing, they're just cool with being themselves. And I heard Turkey is like that too. Like it's much more liberal. Is that true?
Well, it is relatively liberal when you compare it to the rest of the Muslim world, especially to the whole Arab countries that are kind of neighboring Turkey. It is in general, Turkic countries happen to be more secular Muslim countries. So there are a lot of people who actually don't really believe in Islam, who don't really care. But the population still says that over 80% of the population still says that religion is at least somewhat important in their lives. And more than 90% still identifies as Muslim. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we have among the young population, between 20 and 30 especially, there are a lot of people who now identify as deists or atheists, especially that part of the population that is more interested in interacting internationally and in going on Twitter, for example. There is this part of the population that uses Twitter, which is a more distinct part of the population. Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, you see polls where you see that there are like 30% of Twitter users are atheists, 20% of them are deists, and 30% are Muslims, which is a crazy number, which is extremely surprising. Mm-hmm. So you see stuff like that going on. And Turkey is really, really changing. People are really increasingly kind of doubting what Islam can really promise and give them. So there is some change happening. I would still say that we are very far away from Turkey changing into a rather irreligious country, because people still have this illusion, although Turks don't really understand what Islam is. They don't really, they have their own secular version of Islam, Sufi secular version of Islam. And they think that the whole Arab population that is all too Islamic, they all think, oh, that's just Arab culture, you know, that's what they think, which is why I created a Turkish YouTube channel now to enlighten people about what Islam really is and what it teaches.
Okay,
I'm doing that now. So I was about the whole ex-Muslim label thing, by the way. Some big YouTuber messaged me recently who interacts a lot with people from Muslim backgrounds, and he told me just a few days ago, he said, hey, you know, people don't know that I'm not a Muslim, although I come from a Muslim background, but I have to tell you something. I interact with a lot of people here that who also don't believe in Islam anymore, who don't really, you know, who don't follow Islam. Somewhere in the West, I don't know. He said there's this rising trend of people who don't believe in Islam, but who also don't call themselves ex-Muslims.
Which
just don't talk about Islam anymore. So this is a rising thing, and people like you are helping that. He said to me, that was very encouraging.
Yeah, we definitely want to normalize dissent. We don't really care if anyone uses the ex-Muslim label. I really don't care what anyone believes or disbelieves. The point is.
Same.
That it should be your choice, or everyone should have a choice, and there shouldn't be any compulsion. And even if there was no compulsion, we still have a right to talk about it, because there's a sort of spiritual compulsion there when you're being told you have to do these things, you have to wear hijab, you have to pray 5 times a day, you have to eat halal, you cannot work for a bank. Even if all of these things are opt-in, let's put aside the hijab, because hijab is not exactly opt-in, especially in some families. But if you put all those things as optional, I mean, for me and my family, for my wife and for myself, it was optional. I mean, she could choose to wear hijab or not. I was free to work at a bank if I wanted to. There was no law against it, but I chose not to. All of these decisions that we collectively make as a Muslim community makes also shape the society. And so they're worth talking about, because if you're going to, you know, and it's not necessarily the case that all Muslim women are in the same situation, all Muslim men, you know, for example, certain apologists was trying to say that, oh, my wife has this many degrees and this and that. You know, how dare you guys say that Muslim women are oppressed? But the fact is that many, many, many Muslim families, you know, like Jimmy London is a good example. Jimmy Bangash is a good example of this. He talked about how in his own family, he grew up in a Pakistani family. his sister and him were treated completely differently. He was allowed to go to movies with his dad, and his sister was not allowed. And this is in the UK. I mean, this was a little bit like, this is a generation ago, obviously. Things are changing, but there's definitely a different treatment. And
that's a very moderate example.
Very, and the whole thing about, you know, like the honor culture, how Muslim women are expected to maintain the family honor in by not, you know, having sex outside of marriage, but the men are not allowed to do whatever they want, right? So you have this situation where Muslim women can be attacked. I mean, yeah. We had an example of an honor killing in Canada, where this Pakistani girl, she would wear hijab in front of her father, but then outside of the home she wouldn't wear, and eventually her dad and her brother like actually killed her, unfortunately, mm-hmm. Right? So there's examples like that still happen to this day, and people might say this has nothing to do with Islam, which is, it's a tricky topic, because it's the religion doesn't allow you to do these things, but it's intertwined with the teachings in the sense that, you know, when you have a religion that says that, you know, a woman, and it's complicated, but there's a reason why this happens in Muslim countries all the time, right? And it's difficult to say Islam without looking at the community, without looking at the culture, because the two things are mixed together, and there's no such thing, I believe, there's no such thing as Islam without Muslims. You can't just, like, what's on the book on the shelf is not Islam. What's Islam is what people are practicing, in my opinion. That's how I see it. I see Islam as something that's always changing. What the scholars are teaching, and what Muhammad practiced was completely different than what we have today.
Well, that's what I say to reformists. When reformists tell me, or when Quranists come and tell me, well, that's not real Islam, and Islam is actually supposed to be this and that, I say, hey, it doesn't matter what you think Islam is supposed to be. What matters is that the vast majority of Muslims and Muslim scholars have continued this as Islam. So if I came and decided to talk about, to criticize Islam, depending on what you think Islam really is, that would be completely irrelevant. If I want to criticize Islam, I should be criticizing the Islam that people actually believe in, not the Islam that you think people should be believing in.
Yeah. In a sense, I mean, sometimes we are accused of making a straw man of Islam. And when we say, I mean, and some people do this, some anti-Islamic, I don't know what to call them, apologists or whatever, they will find something in a book that is very obscure and people don't actually know. Muslim, I know, and it's not just no Muslim, because typical Muslims don't know the religion anyways.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to look at what the scholars are saying. But if no scholar actually says, you know, these specific things, that means it's not really part of the religion anymore. But the thing is, obviously, there's a caveat, because if it's something's in the Quran, for example, you know, slavery. Okay, now that's a fair point. Even if Muslims are not doing that, the scholars will still agree that this is a part of Islamic law, that in a war you can capture women and sleep with them and stuff like that. So that's fair game. But if it's something very obscure, that, like, you know, one example is someone came up with this, I'm not going to mention his name, but he came up with this thing that said Surah Falak and Surah Nas. Surah Falak was something to do with Muhammad's genitals. It was so weird. I've never ever heard this before, and it was such a strange thing. Like, that's what I mean by, like, we have to, it's like, we should attack Islam at its strongest. Like, we want to attack Islam that people believe in, not make up an Islam that nobody believes in, that some, you know what I mean, by, like, kind of cutting and pasting. But then we are also accused of the same thing, but they also do that too. Muslims sometimes will say, you're not attacking Islam, you're attacking culture.
No, of course there is a difference. I mean, if we are saying we should be criticizing the Islam that Muslims have established, but yeah. Of course, what also needs to be said is when we criticize Islam, and especially when we show to moderate Muslims, whom I call pop Muslims, when we went to explain to pop Muslims why their religion is a bunch of nonsense, why they shouldn't be following it, why they have been duped, and why they should abandon it, then it is of course the best thing to do to dig out what Islam actually is and what its fundamental scriptures actually teach. For example, when we talk about sex slavery or simply just slavery, for example, we're talking about something that largely doesn't exist in today's time anymore. It exists only in few very very scarce places in the Muslim world. Most Muslims don't practice slavery and don't practice sex slavery, but we still have to bring it up and still have to say, hey, you believe in Islam and you believe that this is a fulfilling religion, but your religion preaches slavery and sex slavery, which completely contradicts with your understanding of how humans, of goodness, of good and evil. So how could you believe in this? So of course we have an obligation to the fundamental scriptures, the fundamental version of Islam.
The problem with the slavery thing is the problem for Muslims is it happened in our lives. It came back,
uh-huh.
Like ISIS, right? Like ISIS brought it back. I mean,
not even just ISIS. It happened in some African countries. It was reported over the last.
Oh, Boko Haram as well. Oh yeah, I forgot about Boko Haram. Haram, ISIS. I mean, this is, but people will say, well, they're not. These are not proper Muslims.
And then you show them the scripture and what it actually says and what historically Muslims have practiced. I mean, it is historically undeniable. It is truly historically undeniable that the Islamic world practiced slavery, that they based their slavery on Islamic law, that slavery was practiced and upheld by the caliphates, which were responsible for upholding and spreading Islam, which is the only reason that most Muslims today believe in Islam, and that they also practiced sex slavery, that they had sex slaves, that Islam ran one of the largest slave trades in the world. In fact, it came before the transatlantic slave trade and ended after the transatlantic slave trade. In the West and everywhere, we like to talk about how white people enslaved black Africans, but we're not really talking about the slavery that actually produced the transatlantic slave trade, which is the Arab slave trade or the Islamic slave trade. It started before the transatlantic slave trade, continued during the transatlantic slave trade, and ended after the transatlantic slave trade, and was forced to be closed down by Western people, by the non-Muslims, by the
Europeans. That's a very good point. That's a very good point, because Muhammad Hijab is here. That's a very good point, because you're right that the Islamic slavery or the Arab slavery actually ended much after the Western countries started ending it. And to me, this is a sort of fundamental problem with like Islam or religion. Well, first of all is who is to say what is an account, who is to say what is actually part of Islam and what is not part of Islam? When the Quran says, you know, this is allowed or that is allowed, how is it that someone can say, well, this is not part of Islam anymore? How can a scholar say that? Let's just ask that question. When a scholar says that, let's say a scholar says this, scholar says slavery is now forbidden in Islam. Okay. Based on what?
Based on what?
It's all man-made at the end of the day. At the end of the day, everything about Islam is man-made, starting from the how the Quran was preserved. Okay, that's a big problem. How the Hadith was preserved, that's a bigger problem. How the rules are interpreted. You have a broom? What's that word?
Yeah, I have a broom here for Muhammad Hijab.
No, that's not him. It's someone else. Okay, it's a fake account. So the whole process.
Just in case.
The whole process is entirely man-made, right? Like when someone says, you know, when someone says this is Islam or this is not Islam, the entire process is going to be a human process, from preserving the books, from deciding which hadith cancels Quran or which Quranic ayah actually abrogated by this ayah. The entire process is man-made, and like, honestly, there's no, it all comes back to a claim of authority, right? Like Graham Wood in his book, The Way of Strangers, when he interviews a bunch of jihadis. He goes to the Middle East, he goes to Egypt, he lives in Egypt for a while, and he meets these people. And the issue, the question he asks Hamza Yusuf and Yasir al-Qadhi, and Hamza Yusuf got really mad. He kept asking Hamza Yusuf, why do you think this is wrong, ISIS, right? Uh-huh. Hamza Yusuf, he said at the end, got so flustered, he stood up and he pointed at the wall and he said, see this? You see this? This is my chain of authority that goes back to Muhammad. And I have ijaza. And that was his entire argument. His argument was an argument of authority. And this is kind of like the Sufi perspective. The Sufi perspective is that you have a chain, you know, a silsila that goes back to Muhammad, right?
Yeah. I grew up
with approval from this sheikh. We got approval from this sheikh. And because at the end of the day, like, honestly, you can't say that. It's difficult to say ISIS is wrong in everything that they do because there's precedent. It's not just made out of thin air, right? It comes from somewhere.
Of course, it comes from. I mean, there is no denying to the fact that it comes that the things that they do come from Islamic fundamental Islamic scriptures and Islamic history. There is simply no denying to that. We could lengthily, endlessly talk about whether these Islamic jihadist groups like ISIS are part of Islam or not, or whether. Whether the global Muslim population shares their ideas and their beliefs or not, which is a completely hugely different discussion. The thing is that these people, many practices that these people have, that groups like ISIS or Boko Haram or others have, are completely justified by Islamic sources, by Islamic scholars of history, completely justified by fundamental Islamic sources. Are completely supported by Islamic scholars that the vast majority of Muslims base their teachings on and their beliefs on, and all we can really do about this is just to put the sources out there and to show that to those who are not aware. And
so one thing I would say though, I just to be clear, is that. Majority, 99%, 99 probably 0.9% of Muslims completely condemn ISIS.
I wouldn't say 99%. I would probably say 95%. Or
yeah, I guess
over 90%.
I guess the challenge is okay. So yeah, putting a percent is kind of difficult. But what I mean to say is that you know there was a letter. There's actually a website called Letter to Baghdadi. Which is actually signed by, I don't know, 150 or 200 different Muslims in all over the world, like imams and like leaders and stuff like that, that says we completely condemn ISIS and what they're doing is not Islam. Now, I'm willing to grant them that what ISIS is doing is not their Islam. Because like I said, from my perspective, Islam is not one thing. So you don't want to believe in that Islam, I'm happy for you. I'm glad that's not part of your Islam, because Islam is not just one thing. And now the problem I have is when they say it has nothing to do with Islam. That's where I draw the line. I'm like, you can't say it has nothing to do with Islam. And thankfully, Hamza Yusuf has actually kind of sort of admitted that. And he had an article called The Plague Within. Now he's actually trying to blame Salafis. And he's trying to say, well, no, it's their problem. They're not interpreting Islam properly. And actually, this is a common theme among Sufis. Sufis will blame Salafis and they'll say, it's you guys' fault that we have terrorism in Islam because you guys are interpreting everything literally. You don't have this chain of authority. You guys are basically just like making up. Like they attack the Salafi scholar. And to be honest, a lot of terrorism in Islam is coming from that sort of corner of the Islamic world, right? Like Salafis are not into terrorism themselves, but that perspective, that way of saying, I want to bring back the 7th century to today, Salafis are all about that. Like they want to bring back, they think what Muhammad practiced, the way he practiced, the world he lived in was a perfect sort of bubble that they want to bring back. So what they have, what they're trying to do with the stoning and all that is much closer to ISIS. Right, they might, for whatever strange reason, they don't believe in ISIS because they have the way of getting out of it. But they rightfully say, well, I don't know why Salafis don't like ISIS.
You know what the giant hypocrisy is? It makes me sick sometimes just thinking about it. Which is, it has been a common narrative among pop Muslims, among most Muslims, mainstream Muslims, Muslims around the world, and non-Muslims who want to support this narrative, to say that that ISIS are not Muslims, that those terrorists are not Muslims, that not that they have nothing to do with Islam, that they not cannot even be counted Muslims, that they are non-Muslims, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And their reasoning for that is that groups like ISIS have some practices that they think are not acceptable in their mainstream version of Islam, or they think those practices are not acceptable according to Islam. Some practices contradict with Islam, such as I would even agree with maybe one or two things. One issue is the issue of burning people alive, for example.
Yeah,
which seems to be contradictory to the consensus of Islamic scholars and the teachings of Islam.
Now, have you heard the justification for that?
Which one?
Like why? How they justify this?
I think they justify it as a retaliation. Yes. Because their people are burnt by.
That was in the book too, actually.
Yeah. Which actually makes sense if you look at it from an Islamic perspective. You could justify that from an Islamic.
That's Islamic the problem, right? Like,
yeah, that's the issue.
Yeah. Now, what takes authority? Now, what takes a higher authority? That's a human process, and some scholars will say no, what he said takes authority over this situation. The other one will say no, that one takes authority, and who's right? Who's wrong?
See, that's what I'm getting to. Another issue is the issue of detonating yourself among innocent people and killing them in a war. But the thing is, you know, the Muslim would say, well, this clearly goes against the teachings of Islam. Islamic teachings even say that someone who does this is not one of us. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, ISIS again comes and justifies that by saying that according to Islamic sources and the Hadith, it is very clear that if we are in a state of war, that the casualties among the common population are something that is expected. You know, that's expected in Islam. In fact, Ibn Taymiyyah himself, whom they based their teachings on, argued lengthily about these issues, and they came to accept that waging war against the invaders, the non-Muslim invaders, the Mongolians, was justified, and the means of war that they pursued were justified. So the issue comes down to when mainstream Muslims reject groups like ISIS in public and say, well, those are not Muslims, those don't represent us, they're actually non-Muslims because they do these and these things. That is very vague and very lazy, because the same Muslims also claim that all the Muslim countries that we have today are Muslims, despite the fact that the majority of Muslim countries are completely majority of Muslim countries are ruled by rules that would label them all as non-Muslims, as heretics, as infidels.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, that's a good point. That's actually a really funny point. You can't. It's a slippery slope, right? Like if you're saying they're not Muslim, and funny thing is, the calling people non-Muslims is a favorite of terrorist groups.
Yeah.
They love to do this. So now when Muslims are doing this to other groups, they have to be careful, because that's one step away from, like, that is a perfect way, because Islam says you're not allowed to kill Muslims. So how do terrorists work? Because they kill a lot of Muslims, right? They say, you're not Muslim, you're not a proper Muslim, you're not a true Muslim. And then what they do is, based on that, they say, okay, well, now we can actually execute you because you left Islam. But you're right, they can't say, really, ISIS is not, they're not Muslim.
They say we're in a state of war, and the Muslims that die are in our war and reject our authority, which our authority has been established by the Prophet Muhammad. And if we are in a war and the Muslims reject our authority and help the infidel, then they are our enemies, and we are justified to kill them. That's what they say, and that is completely justified by Islamic by Islamic sources, by the way, by Islamic scholarly consensus from centuries ago. So. Really, there is not much room for Muslims who want to argue that ISIS are not real Muslims or not Muslims at all. It is completely vague. It's not really up to them. And if we talk about it from an historical Islamic perspective, we would end up agreeing that they are Muslims, although their rulings and teachings differ slightly from the mainstream Muslim consensus. And if ISIS claims that they have established a caliphate, which Muhammad has called, has authorized, in clearly authentic hadith, then there is really not much for the mainstream Muslims to argue. But the only reason they want to claim that ISIS were not real Muslims and not Muslims at all is because we live in different times now, and Muslims are now in an international arena judged by the public eye, by the public non-Muslim eye, and they somehow have to distance themselves from the savages that ISIS are.
I think in general, you know, people are like, I'll put myself back in my Muslim shoes. When I was Muslim, one of the worst feelings as a Muslim, I was in Canada, obviously, not that it really matters, but one of the worst feelings as a Muslim is finding out that there was a terrorist attack and dreading, were they Muslims? Because that's the last thing you want to hear, because one, it causes a lot of problems for you as a Muslim, but two, it makes Islam look bad. And as a Muslim, you know, I'm like, this has nothing to do with Islam. And, you know, I was Salafi leaning towards most of my Islamic life, and Salafis are very, very strongly against terrorism. Even though most Salafis become terrorists, which is kind of funny, that's a different topic. But the Salafi scholars themselves, like Ibn Uthaymeen, and they're very much against terrorism, partly because Saudi, you know, terrorism is a scourge in Saudi, right? And it's a big problem for Saudis because terrorists would want to kill the Saudi government. They're the first ones to say you're a kafir, you're allied with America, and they'll actually want to kill the Saudi government, right? Just like they did with Anwar Sadat in Egypt, right? Like, they killed him, they assassinated him for, you know, for allying with Israel. So the thing is, they don't like this because it's bad for them, right? And they actually don't believe that this is allowed. They think that you need to have a caliphate in order to have jihad. And this is a Hanafi opinion as well, that in order to declare jihad, you have to have an emir. The thing is, there's massive cognitive dissonance. Okay, but this is the problem. The problem is, typical Muslims have cognitive dissonance. They don't, and I don't think people are getting this in the chat. We're not saying ISIS represents Islam. We're saying it represents one form of, at least I'm saying it represents one form of Islam.
It does, yeah.
Which you
they,
can't
they are Muslims.
Even if admitted this, right? Like even even Muslims, even the Imam in Mecca has acknowledged that we don't agree with ISIS, but not on the theology, just based on what they're doing.
You know what I find very funny? There's this Islamic website, this very, very traditionalist one, Islam QA.
I'm curious, the Salafi website. Which one? There's two Islam QAs. There's a Salafi one, and then there's a traditional one, which is a Hanafi one.
The big Islam QA.
The big one's the Salafi one, IslamQA.info.
I read it sometimes just to, you know, during my researches to see what they say about certain topics and to get their approach, to get regular Muslim approaches and all that stuff. And then I came across, whenever you come across questions about ISIS there, when people send questions about ISIS, what they do is they say, we prefer not to talk about these things. You know, that's what they say. So they don't say, you know, we condemn ISIS and this and that. You know, they just say, we prefer not to talk about this topic at all.
Here's the Imam I was talking about. It's on my blog. He talks about this basically, and he says that, you know, we criticize them, but like, we don't criticize the ideology because it's the same. He actually admitted it, right? And you see this quote from Islam QA that about the slavery. You're talking about Islam QA. Islam QA, as I was saying, has the most hardline approach and the most literal approach, which is why they end up joining these groups, because it's a problem for them. Like, they don't want terrorism, yet they're saying the same things that the terrorists are saying and these bad people are saying, right? So, you know what I'm saying? It's just like, you can't have your cake and eat it too, right? That's the problem they have.
Yeah, you might want to correct yourself, by the way. I think earlier, as you were talking about Salafis, I think you said something like, which is funny because most Salafis become terrorists. People might take that out of context.
What I meant to say is the majority of people the majority of Islamic terrorists come from the Salafi. Yeah.
I understand that you meant that, but I think you misspoke there.
Exactly what I meant. I meant that what you find is the biggest group of people that become, they come from this sect or this sort of understanding of Islam.
Yeah.
As that is the, unfortunately, the one that that's most in line, right, with the views of the terrorists, right? Unfortunately. Uh-huh. James was asking, you know, he said, remember when Brunei studied the death penalty for homosexuality and celebrities got really outraged and pressure was put against and the law was ended. Could that outrage be stimulated against other countries with similar laws? I think for me, I'll just go first and then I'll let you answer that.
Sure.
For me, I think this is the importance of being a fair critic of Islam, because the Muslim community is going to throw dirt and shade at us and try to say we're bigots, we hate Muslims, which is weird because most of my family is Muslim, right? I mean, my family, I had a good relationship with my family. They didn't attack me for leaving Islam. I have a good relationship with my family. Personally, I'm a minority here. My family's really liberal. But because we have, when we maintain the moral, upper moral ground, people see this, right? And this is why recently I've got a lot of personal abuse. I mean, there was that video that came out that was a four Muslim apologist, and they were respectful for the most part, and they were good. Other than, you know, there was some mocking and some stuff going on. But when I did a response to that, I got a lot of like personal attacks from that. And I'm not lowering myself to that because I don't care what they do because I'm not like them. And the funny thing is, from my perspective, if you're the Muslim, you believe in Allah, your book says, you know, if a person of ignorance comes to you, say salam, you're supposed to be going by the best example, Muhammad. Yet you guys are making personal attacks, attacking, you know, the way I talk. You know, this guy was like talking in a high-pitched voice. He said something about being autistic. He said, if he was autistic, then I would understand. If he was super autistic, I would understand where he's coming from. But he's not, so I don't get it. Like, it's just like really.
I think it is a very natural result of Islamic teaching and behavior.
I guess maybe from my perspective, I think they should be doing the opposite. They should be, but you're right. When someone's an enemy of Allah, this is a problem. When someone becomes an enemy of Allah, then there's no, basically there's like all, then the gloves are off and then you can do whatever you want. And some, again, it's a pick and choose thing, right? I mean, some people will say, well, I should look at the gentle part of Muhammad, but you're right. There is a perspective in Islam as well, that if someone's attacking your religion, then you can do whatever you want.
I mean, it is no surprise that Muslims are the most hostile religious group in the world. It's not a mystery why that is the case. I mean, I'm sorry to say it bluntly like this, but there is just no denying to it. Everyone knows this. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. You can talk to any religious group, talk about any religious group. The most hostile approach you will get, the most hostile response you will get, is from the Islamic circle, and that is by no means a coincidence. It is just you might have experienced a rather soothing, moderate, mystical Islamic side and movement and sect, which I have too. To be honest, I grew up in a Sufi environment, although with very harsh teachings, Salafi like teachings about the infidels and the heretics. But the average Muslim learns a shit ton of pretty bad stuff about the non-Muslims. And if you just
I agree with you that all of that is there. When I said my family was okay with me leaving Islam, what I mean to say was my Sunni family. So my mom is Sunni and all of her family is Sunni. My dad's Ismaili side is very small. I mean, it's just two brothers. One of them died, so they're fine. They're like, they don't care at all. They're like, whatever you want, I mean, it's cool. But my Sunni family is very liberal too. Like, my parents had a like dating / love marriage. They're very liberal. We grew up in Kenya, and Kenya is not like Pakistan. Uh-huh. Kenya is very, very liberal. It's very mixed, very multicultural. So the family structure, and so they were sad when I left Islam, but they didn't attack me, like, and they didn't kick me out and abuse me like what I've heard from some other ex-Muslims, like the experiences they got, right? And something I thought that was very interesting that Ali Rizvi mentioned right now was, he's been making a lot of posts about Donald Trump, and he said that the type of responses he's getting now from the far right exactly the same responses he was getting from the Muslim community when he was talking about Islam. And he hasn't, now he's been talking a lot about the election and stuff like that.
Ali Rizvi should shut the hell up. He has no idea what he's talking about. I'm sorry, Ali Rizvi. I find his approach to Muslims and others very emotional and very inaccurate. He usually he takes his political activism too much out of context and bases his Muslim experience on as he admits an extremely liberal upbringing where he basically didn't have to experience Islam at all. I don't agree with that at all. And
so, I don't think he's talking about his upbringing. He's talking about the response he gets from Muslims, because he's.
I know. The thing is, he doesn't understand the average Muslim. He doesn't understand how the average Muslim thinks, how the average Muslim is, because he was not an average Muslim. Because he was a very fringe form of Muslim, a very liberal, a very progressive form of Muslim that 90% of Muslims don't experience.
I think he was mainstream Shia, so he was a 12th. He was in the 12th sect. I was in a very fringe sect. Ismailism is a very, very fringe sect compared to like Shiaism is basically, you know, about 10% of the Muslim population, and they're not considered. But yeah, you're right, his family is liberal. But what I was saying in regard to this specific quote is that, and because Ali has posted a lot of really inflammatory content, much more than I do. Like, for example, one of the best examples is the Kaaba with the rainbow flag on it. Like, that was like people saw it as very hostile. He supports Ayman Nawabi in his like Allah is gay campaign. I mean, we had a debate about this on his podcast, and they were on your side. They were like, we should mock, we should do all these things. And I was like, I don't know if this is productive, man. I don't think we should talk like this and say Allah is gay. And they're like, no, we should say this. Allah is an imaginary, like him and Ayman are more alike than you imagine, I would think.
I don't know. I don't even think that the whole Kaaba and rainbow flag is very inflammatory. It hasn't produced the same outrage that some mockery of Muhammad produces, for example. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that is a proper understanding of what inflammatory is to the average Muslim community, which is
they're pissed about that. They were damn pissed. Like a rainbow flag, basically a gay flag on the Kaaba.
Who really cares about it right now? I mean,
they do though. They actually do. That's the thing.
I don't know. I don't really see that, but maybe it's just me. I don't know. I think they care much more about how you talk about the Prophet Muhammad, for example.
Yeah, they do actually. Muhammad is put, you know, at a very high pedestal and almost worshipped. I mean, like the way Muslims act when you talk about Prophet Muhammad. Is he's more important than Allah?
It is funny. Muslims react much more angry to criticism and mockery of Muhammad than they react to criticism and mockery of Allah.
Yeah,
I mean, criticism and mockery of Allah goes largely unnoticed, and you know, they don't even care. Often.
Or even Jesus, right? Like that's another thing that.
Yeah.
So what I want to give an example, a counter example to your point, which is. When that movie came out about the gay Jesus movie, they were actually, I was going to make a video on this, but I never ended up doing it. They were actually bombed or attacked the movie makers by Christians. So that doesn't happen as often. I think that doesn't happen as often because I do think that you're right, that Islam has some really troubling aspects that lead to these things. I agree with you. I agree with you there. But I think at a very human nature, all of us are very similar. And when we're poked, we react. Now, I think Islam kind of magnifies this. And because Muhammad himself, you know, assassinated his opponents. He allowed lying. And, you know, there's examples like Ka'b ibn Ashraf, where he told his companions, according to the story, they asked him, can we lie? He's like, yeah, you can lie. So they told him, hey, will your friends, can you come out? And the story goes, his wife was like, don't do it. Right? And he's like, no, these are my friends. And they went out and they killed him. Right. So there's examples like this, right? There's example, and you know all these examples. The slave woman who was insulting Muhammad, the owner killed her, and Muhammad said, you don't have to pay blood money. There's a lot of examples like that in the Islamic text, which is, you know, fodder for the extremists, right? Extremists. So unfortunately, there is this precedent in this, because you don't find, I agree with you there, but I think if you push people enough in any religion, any worldview, they will give you death threats, which is true. Like when I used to first talk about death threats, people used to say, well, I get death threats from feminists, which is not really that common, I think, but it can be if you look on if you go online and you provoke people enough. I think anybody, even Trump supporters or even Muslims or Christians, I think you will get that sort of response, but to different levels.
I think our image of this is largely distorted. I definitely agree that humans have a thing. If they are provoked very much, especially in hard times, they will have harsh reactions to things. But I think that is like I can't really find a comparison to that right now. But arguing that right wingers or Christians, for example, can be or are right now or at some time just as angry and mad in their reactions mm-hmm. as the average Muslim, for example, would be a huge distortion of reality mm-hmm. and a huge disconnection of reality, especially if you compare the right in America or Christians in average Christian countries, in average developed or developing Christian countries, to average Muslim responses in average Muslim countries. You are very far far away from the facts, from the reality. In an average Muslim country, if you only practice a fraction of the criticism of political ideas and traditions and religion that Ali Rizvi, for example, practices of Christianity or right wing politics, mm-hmm. You wouldn't just get these angry reactions like, hey, fuck you, mm-hmm. hey, whatever, you know,
yeah.
you're gay, you know, you wouldn't just get stuff like that. And he probably, I wanted to say, and he knows that, but he maybe doesn't know, I don't know.
He said that actually in his book. He said that when I got the freedom to speak like this, I told myself I would take this responsibility seriously, because he grew up in Pakistan, which is the worst. Was it Pakistan or was it Saudi? A little bit in Pakistan, a little bit in Saudi. He lived in these very, very conservative societies where he and his family had to hide and do like Jummah in secret because Shias are not allowed to do Jummah or something in Saudi. So they had the secret meetings. So I think he suffered under Islamic conservatism too from that regard. But yeah, I guess it's hard to,
but he still makes the comparison, then I think that there's something really wrong with that. I don't know. I think it is extremely hard and hugely taken out of proportion if you compare the average Christian reaction or the average right wing reaction to the average Muslim reaction. It is.
But do you not agree that right wing extremism in America has become a big problem? I mean,
I don't.
Like, doesn't the data show that the number of deaths is actually more now from right wing extremists towards minorities than Muslims attacking in America? Like, I mean, FBI and other groups have
mentioned. What does that number mean? If you go per capita, then it means that if you go per capita, you should look at it per capita. If you compare per capita incidence of extremism by Muslims compared to per capita numbers of extremism by right wingers, you will see a huge difference. You will see that only a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of right wingers are actually dangerous or violent, whereas in comparison, a very
extreme. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. I'm not saying right wingers are dangerous in general.
Yeah.
I'm saying that there's a threat that's becoming bigger and bigger.
You're more likely to be. More likely to be.
You know, honestly, we could blame the liberal sort of overreaction, and I agree in that sense that they're making the problem worse, right? And they're causing this to be, because if we cannot talk about Islam, I mean, I feel like what we're doing is we're actually solving the problem a bit, because we're able to openly discuss these issues without, you know, if people like us get shut down, then what's going to happen is you're going to have the more extremist sort of far right leaning groups are going to come out and they're going to do what they do, right?
Yeah, I think people are just misunderstanding things and often reacting emotionally to certain stuff. I mean, it's reminds me of how people say, oh, crime is getting worse and the streets are becoming unlivable, everything is becoming dangerous, you can't even go outside anymore. In the past, it used to be where we were all safe, which is this is a very common assumption, for example. This is something very common that people say. And a very quick research based on facts, based on statistics, shows that that is completely untrue, that the opposite is actually true, that crime is not rising, that crime is actually decreasing, that the streets are not becoming unsafer, they're actually becoming safer, that incidents of murder and rape are actually hugely in decline, and that even crimes against property are in decline. You know, that is the reality. And I compare that to stuff like when people talk about how certain groups have become more dangerous in our time, the only thing that they actually see is that they are more exposed to news, to news of certain incidents happening, or that minorities have become larger in number, or that the right wing has become more able to express themselves or more able to take certain actions, which is why numbers increase. So it all has very easy, very basic statistical explanations. And I hate this constant fear mongering, this constant talk, this constant distraction, constant complaining about the right wing. There is no danger of the right wing. You are more likely to be struck in a goddamn lightning. You know.
Before I get back to this, I just want to address this. This super chat, someone saying, David the Goliath is saying, will Ramadan lead to more deaths if Muslim fasts? If fasting may compromise the immune system? That's a good question. I'm not an expert on the science of fasting. I do think it can actually strain your body, very much so. I'm wondering what's going to happen. Like, I'm really wondering, is Hajj going to be canceled this year? Ramadan can't be canceled. Ramadan's still a while away, I think. It's, you know, there's still a few months to go. It's going to be Hajj first. So that's going to be the bigger question. Is Hajj going to be canceled? Because that's like a good $8 billion to $12 billion in revenue for the Saudi government. I don't know if they're going to cancel it or not. And I think there's been some positive news that Muslims are actually, imams are canceling the Hajj. The Tawaf was canceled for a while, going around the Kaaba. Many mosques have closed down. Many people are not going for Jummah now. Some mosques are defiant, and some, you know, Islamic gatherings are still happening, which is unfortunate. Like I read in Bangladesh, there was a big Muslim gathering, which was so dumb to do this at this time. It's just so stupid. Some people are, you know, even some millennials are being sort of defiant and saying, oh, we're going to go to the clubs and we're going to go to the pubs. We don't care, which is going to cause this thing to kind of spread further and further, unfortunately. I just want to share my screen for 1 second. Again, I'm not an expert on this issue. But I do think that we should acknowledge that there is a real sort of thing that's becoming an issue, right? Like it's there, and it doesn't seem to be going away. It seems to be getting worse. This article on Business Insider is not like an academic thing, but it says all of the extremist killings in the US in 2018 had links to right-wing extremism. So there is a real thing that I feel is happening right now.
I would need to read the article, but I think these are very, very usually very deceptive, very emotionally fueled talks, often pushed by left wing people, pushed by left wing talking points, pushed by Muslim talking points. I mean, seriously, we are constantly switching from talking about Islamic extremism and Islamic terrorism to talking about how the right wing is actually becoming very dangerous too. I don't even know the numbers, but I would guess that probably 200 people died, or 200 people died in 1 year, or maybe not even 200, probably like 50 people died or something in 1 year. That's probably the case. That's probably what I would guess, mm-hmm. Based on my experience of looking at these numbers. That might even be too much. I believe it should be even lower than that. Mm-hmm. I just don't. It makes me mad that we are constantly being distracted from this. When we talk about Islamic extremism dominates the world when it comes to extremism. Islamic terrorism kills populations when it comes to extremism. Islamic extremism dominates 95% of terrorism in the world, of politically religiously motivated killings in the world. compared to that, there is literally almost no Christian extremism existence, no extremism of any other kind existence. Maybe only regionally in some ways.
Like Lloyd's Resistance Army, and there's those groups.
We keep talking about right wing extremism and how the right has become dangerous, and completely ignoring other numbers, completely ignoring why there might be some increase in right wing incidents, completely ignoring what dominates our political talks, what dominates the indoctrination that we get from the media, the indoctrination of how we should just ignore Islam, of how we should just ignore the people's demands to put some regulations on immigration matters, on religion matters, on all kinds of things. We just ignore everything that the left says, every problem that the left creates. We ignore every problem that the Islamic population creates. We ignore all demands of the right. And then we look at a few numbers and say, oh, don't we all realize how dangerous the right has become? People.
I think this is, so before I respond, we'll probably get to the end now. It's been an hour. And I really appreciate your time and coming on my channel. Hopefully we'll have a second one, maybe on your channel. And we can get into some more of these topics, including humanism, another thing that you briefly discussed, I saw on your last live stream. I just want to answer the super chat. Zatinian said, I'd love to follow your footsteps. You guys inspired me and examine the superstition of my youth to Judaism. It deserves responsibility for being the parent of Abrahamic religions. Advice how to be. Do you have any response for that?
What was that?
So I'd love to follow your footsteps and examine the superstition of my youth, Judaism. And it's saying it's a parent of Abrahamic religions. Advice on how to begin.
Well, I would say the advice on how to begin is I don't really know what to say when people ask it this way. I mean, I would just start questioning the core beliefs of that you have if you learned them, and then obviously the most important part to start is that you could just read the scripture, read mm-hmm. what your scriptural beliefs are. What your current beliefs are largely based on, and examine those, and try to figure out whether those align with your understanding or with modern understandings and proofs of the world and morality. And
that's a beautiful answer. That's a beautiful answer. That's far better than what I was just gonna say. I would read Bart Ehrman. Like, I love Bart, and he's talked about Judaism and the connection to Christianity and how the beliefs of Judaism evolved and became Christianity. I think he did a wonderful job. If you want to get his books, or you can just Google How Jesus Became God, UCC. He has a talk. It's like a 3-hour talk, and he goes through most of the best arguments in his book. So that would be my answer. And like Apostle Prophet Livon said, you know, like go meta, look at the beliefs and see whether they make sense and start from there. Okay, so in response to what you said, I think that both deserve time. I think that both the issue of Islam and Islamic extremism and right-wing extremism. So right-wing extremism, I think, to me at least, is becoming a problem. But like, again, it's not the focus of what I'm talking about, and it shouldn't take away in any way from what I'm speaking about, which is Islam. That's all I have to say to that. I don't disagree with you in the fact that we should focus on Islam because that's what we know best. But even if it was 200 deaths compared to, let's say, 2000 from Islamic extremism, it doesn't make it any less bad that this is also a bad, like, just like, you know, people are saying, why don't you talk about this? Why don't you talk about this? I'd say in the same way, if there is an issue that's becoming an issue, then doesn't mean we have to talk about it, but it's still an issue. It doesn't become an issue just because there's another worse issue out there. That's what I would say.
I'm currently having a brief look at the article. The article actually doesn't give any further information. It links to an ADL article. I'm looking at the ADL article, and the ADL article says that 2018 there were, as I guessed, as I lowered it to 50, it said there were 50 killings related to extremism. They were linked to right-wing extremism, and this is one of the 4 years in the last. Since 1970, that we have seen a big rise, and So in 1970, there were also 50 cases. Mm-hmm. And we are talking about how there is an increase.
So last thing then, we'll end it on that.
That was 50 years ago.
So last thing we'll do, we'll end it on this now because we've gone over the hour. Question, and I'll let you answer first. Solitary Emmy says, what would it take for you guys to be Christians? If you guys convert thousands, more would too. What would it take? So I'll go first. I just want to say one thing. I don't think that if we convert thousands more would. I don't think that's the case. I don't think people look up to us that much. I actually thought when I left Islam that when I found out something that if people knew would cause them to leave Islam, but it didn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen, because for me, this was a game changer. I found facts that contradicted, and I'm like, done. Islam's not true. But I didn't realize that people are much more emotionally attached to the beliefs than I originally thought. And the best example of this that I recently posted about is Malcolm X. Malcolm X thought he had a smoking gun against Elijah Muhammad. Now, all Muslims will agree Elijah Muhammad is a fake prophet. He's a liar, and you know, he made up this religion. But Malcolm X had this secret that he found out, that Elijah Muhammad was sleeping with little, like with his secretaries, right? Mm-hmm. He knew this. People didn't know this, but he knew his prophet was a hypocrite, and he was not following the same advice that he was teaching the young men to be chaste and get married, and he was having these extramarital affairs. He thought, and he said this, I thought if I told people this, they will all follow me and leave Islam, Nation of Islam. He was dead wrong. People did not leave the nation because of this. Instead, they attacked him. They said, you were biting the hand that bit you. Elijah Muhammad did so much good for us. He did so much good for the blacks that why should we, you know, now turn our backs on him just because of the small thing he did? They're like, they made an excuse for him. Some of them cried, some of them were sad, but they didn't leave. Most of them did not leave the nation. And I don't think that religious belief is a rational thing in general, any belief that we have. It's not that easy to change people's minds. And so I don't think people would change just because of us. I mean, I think people would be happy and they'd be supportive. I think the Christian community would very much love that. But I don't think that it would have that sort of impact. What would you say?
I think the example with the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad is actually a very good starting point. But the Nation of Islam believes in extremely absurd things, by the way, such as that Allah came as a human to America and told them to start this movement. You know, people upon learning these big secrets probably didn't stray away and just held on to what they believe in or what they have because most people care more about the safety and the familiarity they have than they care about the facts that they are shown. So people really just want to feel safe and want to feel familiar, want to feel embraced. If you tell them a lot of facts, I tend to give people just all the facts, you know, when I talk about morality, for example, and I tend to not give them a different direction. Like I don't offer them anything else. And that might just feel a little bit cold to some people because people are looking for something that embraces them, that gives them security, that gives them safety. But coming to what would make me, what was the question? Was that?
So like, what would it take for you to leave Islam, basically? To become Christian, sorry, not leave Islam, you left Islam.
Yeah, I was supposed to confused. What would
it take for you to become Christian?
What would it take for you guys to become Christian? Well, I might have said before that I actually sympathize with Christianity among religions. I never want this to be taken out of context. I want this to be clearly understood among religions. So I like to study religion. I like to look into religions, and I like the Christian system because I find it more productive and more productive in general. Maybe I have a bias because I was raised in the West, and I always thought that Western society and Christian society, the Christian community, was kind of what was good in comparison to Islam, for example. I still think that Christianity has a lot of problems when it comes to morality, and when it comes to its history and to its beliefs and superstitions, if we may call it. So what would make me believe in Christianity would probably be actually just the belief in firstly to believe in God. If I did believe in God, if God made sense, then and if I was convinced that there might be a God, that God might exist, that God is maybe true, then I could maybe proceed from that and then look into the Christian explanation of God and be interested in that and subscribe to that. But the thing is, there is a step missing. I wouldn't first convert to Christianity and then think about God. I would first check if I believe in the existence of this God or not. And if I think about God, I just think that I'm done with it. There is simply no way out of it. There is no explanation to it. There is no way out. I don't believe in God. I cannot believe in God. I have reasons that make it impossible to believe in God, because there are logical flaws in why God would exist and why God would create humanity and the earth. Yeah. And as long as that exists, there is simply no way to become a Christian. I will hopefully soon reveal why I don't believe in God. I'm planning a video on that
with David. Debate, you mean?
No, I'm actually making a sole video about why I don't believe in God. Like, I think people have asked forever, and I should probably.
Your last video, I should just call that out on the Quran's flat earth was very good and very well done. And I think you presented it well, and you put good diagrams in there that like really show you like what did these people think back then, and like you know, because it's kind of difficult. I think sometimes we project the modern. Muslims in general try to project the modern scientific paradigm onto the Quran, and so some things don't really jive really well, but the way you put it, I mean, what just makes perfect sense because it's coherent, whereas trying to mix modern science with the Quran is not coherent. It causes problems, right?
So
thank you so much. This was a great conversation, a little like long overdue. And everyone, I guess, knows you and where to find your channel, but I will link that as well in the comment, in the description. So check out Apostate Prophet's channel, and I guess see you guys again. Thank you so much for all the donations as well. That was very kind of you guys. And see you again in the future.
Thank you so much. Stay away from Islam.